Welcome to episode 5 of the Filmmaker Film Watcher podcast. I'm filmmaker Richard Igorio.
And I'm film watcher Greg Ralph.
So this episode, we are going to delve into some Aussie films. This is our Aussie.
At which point I'm contractually obliged to say, oi, oi, oi.
Episode. Which we're looking at 3 Australian films this episode. So we're going to be looking at Jocelyn Moorhouse's Proof from 1991.
And then we're going to look at Romulus, My Father, made in 2007.
And then we're going to look at the year 2000 film Chopper.
So let's go for gold, Ricardo. Why don't you tell us about our first film, Proof?
Okay. Directed by Jocelyn Moorhouse, this 1991 film centres around Martin, Hugo Weaving, a blind man who struggles with trusting anybody, an issue which started in childhood. He's an interesting character who also takes photographs for proof that people are telling him the truth and not lying to him when they describe photos he takes. He describes them as pictures in Braille. He's looked after by his housekeeper, Celia, Genevieve Pico, who taunts him by rearranging the furniture in his house but secretly loves him. He meets a dishwasher, Andy, Russell Crowe, who starts to gain Martin's trust because of his talent for describing Martin's pictures in 10 words or less. It's a lovely friendship until Celia's jealousy sabotages it by luring Andy's affection for her own gain. Moorhouse's direction is wonderful in this, capturing probably the best snapshot of a blind man's senses ever seen on film. Really. Her use of sound coupled with visuals is fantastic and subtle. Hugo Weaving is so believable as Martin, which highlights this. But the performances of Pico and Crow are also great, bringing together a three-hander that is funny, poignant, and ultimately moving. Greg?
Well, this is a film that we've both seen before, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember seeing it years ago when it first saw it. Was that 1991? So
yes.
That's over a quarter of a century ago. And I remember really enjoying it. And the first time I saw it, you know, an audience at the cinemas. And the scene, or the sequence rather, around going to the drive-in together.
Oh, it's great.
And when Andy goes off to buy chips and lollies and Martin is left alone in the car and starts exploring Andy's car and finding things, then inadvertently gets into a fight with, you know, the local hoons.
Yes.
And then they go screaming out of the drive-in where blind Martin is driving the car, then picked up by the police, then run to the back of the police car, and then end up in hospital. And there's a couple of really funny lines there as well.
There is.
The audience, including myself, was hooting.
Yeah.
In what is actually quite a... It's a bittersweet film. There's a lot of almost darker kind of stuff in it. And there are humorous moments, but that is a very comic highlight of the whole film.
It is.
And I thought, oh, this time around, you know, has the film dated? Is that going to work? Because it's just my wife and I watching it at home, which is a very different context. And it did. It did.
Yeah,
some things in the film look a little dated visually, I think, because it's the 90s and that's, you know,
I think the haircuts and so on is dated that way. I also think musically it's dated a bit. And some of the lines in the screenplay have dated in terms of, you know, things
like,
have dated.
Like what? Do you...
Like when he says... Yeah, what do you call this? Poof to heaven or something?
Oh, yes,
you know,
yeah.
Things like that. I just found that very dated. It is, you know, I think those things have dated. But the essential ingredients of the movie work very well and still are very good. And that's such an important moment in, you know, and they've done it in such a clever way, just in terms of that funny moment. But what it's done there, and there's a great sequence.
Well, they bond.
They really bond. And then when you see Hugo Weaving, Martin, actually sit there and start, and it's like he's finding it very difficult to laugh, but then he just lets out that laugh, this bottled up laugh, because he's so serious a lot of the time. It's a great moment. It's very good.
But there are lots of great moments. That is a highlight, but there's lots of things that happen in the film, some of which I remembered, some I forgot. So when Celia basically blackmails Martin to go into a concert with her, and when he responds to that, and unbeknownst to him, she starts silently weeping because she's so overjoyed that he feels that way about this experience that she's given him. That was the bit where I truly believe that she loves him. Before that, it's obvious from the start when you first meet her, this is not someone who plays nice. You know, she does all these things like watches him, not letting him know she's in the room, moving furniture around so he can trip over it in his own home.
Holding the dog in the park.
In the park, and so he doesn't know what's going
playing
on.
Playing games.
Yeah, she plays games with him. Yeah. And so I first read her as being, you know, just a game player, someone who just enjoys exerting control and power in that part of her life. But in the concert scene, that little silent moment of just these couple of tears going down her face, for me at least, transformed my understanding of her as a character,
absolutely,
as a person, and what she's really on about, completely, which is she really loves him.
Completely.
And in fact, he's playing games with her because he knows that,
mm-hmm,
and he uses that to get her to stay and meet his, you know, daily cooking and cleaning needs.
Yes.
And there's just that wonderful part when she first starts to realise there's somebody else in his life, and she finds corners of Andy in the photographs.
What a great moment that is. That is a fantastic moment. Visually, it's spectacular when she finds the photos and pretty much builds Andy to see what he looks like in these photographs.
And do you know where those photos came from?
Where did they come from?
The photos were actually taken by PJ Hogan, who's another well-known Australian
director.
He is,
yes. He's
Muriel's Wedding, My Best Friend's Wedding, and is, in fact, Jocelyn Moorhouse's husband.
Mm.
And I don't think at that stage he had actually directed a film before. So she was making proof, which originally was meant to be a short film, couldn't get funding, but somehow she got funding for a feature film, which is terrific.
It took a long time to get up, though.
Yeah,
it took a long time to get up.
And so when they needed those things, she was caught up in the whole filming. So she sent PJ Hogan and Russell Crowe out, and it's obviously around Luna Park in St Kilda, here in Melbourne, and they went out and took all those photos. So she didn't take them. She almost inherited them to then use in that sequence and for Genevieve Pico to put together in that way.
Yeah.
And it's such a striking image.
It is.
And not only an image, but a metaphor of her piecing together.
Mm-hmm.
There's this something else going on here. Like, there's so many deft moments in it.
There is. And the flashback sequences really work as well,
yes.
I feel. You know, when we have the final photograph come up, after we've had these flashbacks of the mother when he's, you know, he's a little kid who's blind and his mother's talking about what's outside, and this is where his trust issues come into it.
Because he doesn't know if she's
telling the
truth
or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saying, I can't hear the leaves. She's saying there's a gardener. I can't hear the gardener. I can't hear there's leaves being blown. I can't hear that. You know, what are you just doing that to me? You know, and she said, no. And
he basically thinks that she's being like Celia is now.
Yes, that's
playing
right.
With him.
Playing with him. That's right. And that's where a lot of the trust issues, even to the point where he thinks when his mother's actually dying that he knocks the coffin and says, is it hollow? Did she really die or did she leave me?
No, he says it is hollow.
It is hollow,
yeah,
that's right.
As a child.
And to me, there's so many moments in this film. It's only an hour and a half long, for goodness, you know. You know, and it's beautifully done.
And the other great thing about this film, and both times, even when I've seen it the first time many years ago, you don't know where the story's going.
No.
You've got no idea of the path it's going to follow, where it'll end up. You're just going with it, and yet it holds you, it's believable. It's not trite or cookie cutter kind of storytelling.
No.
It's you're on this journey with these people.
The visual element of the film as well, her use of shadow on faces, you know, it's a low budget film, but what she did filmically in it. And there's a moment when he's describing, Russell Crowe thinks that he killed the cat, but there's not. They go to the vet. And then they're in the restaurant or the cafe, and he says, I was there, Andy. And it goes into this whole visual telling of what he heard, and the sounding of the shoes on the
smell, the feeling of the linoleum, the smell of the perfume, the sound of the overhead lights. Yeah,
it's so beautifully done, that sequence. It's really well done and filmic too. You know, she uses a lot of great angles and perspective, which is very good.
And she hasn't, Jocelyn Moorhouse that is, she hasn't made a lot of films.
No, she's been more of a producer more than a director.
Do you know why?
But, you know.
So she made Proof.
And then she made How to Make an American Quilt.
Which I really like as well.
Yeah,
I'm way overdue to see it again, actually. And then she hasn't made much, if anything, until The Dressmaker a year or two ago.
Well, she did another film in between that as well.
Yeah, there was something. And she, I mean, PJ Hogan was making films as well, of course. But they had four children, two of whom are autistic. And so I heard an interview with her last year. It was really interesting about not only what that does in terms of their family life and things they can and can't do, but also in terms of understanding how a lot of issues around autism in families just aren't dealt with well, and trying to do something in that space as well, I think she was talking about, which is obviously terrific stuff. However, it means we haven't seen as much of her as I'd really like to. Unconditional Love was the other one, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was.
Which I don't think I know anything about.
No, but, I haven't seen that either.
Loved most of Dressmaker, loved Proof, loved How to Make an American Quilt. They're all great films.
Yeah, yeah.
And very nuanced films.
Yeah, look, I think this is actually, I think it was her debut, and it's also, I think it's her best. I think this is a great film. It really is. It's a great Australian movie. I felt the same as you. I thought am I going to find this very dated? You know, the characters and the performances and the story is very strong enough to carry this, you know, what is it, nearly 30 years later?
25. So it's not going to
work. 25, okay, 25.
But also, you talked before about the mother. The casting of, it's Heather Mitchell, isn't it, as the mother? She often plays very cold women and cold mothers. So the fact that you've cast her as the mother actually makes her quite ambiguous.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't, and again, I couldn't remember from the first time I saw it, you don't know whether to believe her or not. You kind of hope she's telling the truth.
Yeah, that's right.
But you don't know. And even when the child, Martin, says, I can't hear that raking of the leaves, and she says, oh, well, you're not listening properly, that feels like she's making it up and she's sort of turning the blame on him. But in fact, she's just a very straight person and she's telling the truth. But the fact it's her, I think, is just really, really smart casting as
what
well.
What did you think of the end shot?
Well, that wasn't originally meant to be in the film. I watched a bit of the Jocelyn Moorhouse commentary I watched this time around. And she spoke about the fact that that shot wasn't part of the original script. It was going to finish with the kind of the rapprochement between Andy and Martin in his lounge room.
Mm.
But they felt they needed something stronger to finish, something, a strong image. And they had a scene that they had shot and didn't use that has the image of him as a child sitting on the chair facing the windows during the rain and then putting his hand up to the window. And I think it's a wonderful thing because you can read, you know, a few things into it. I read that as him finally kind of reaching to the light. You know, he's understood the truth about his mother. She did love him. She was truthful with him.
But when he puts his hand on that window and you hear the sound of the birds, you hear the outside come in. And it's just, that shows me how great the sound design of this movie is as well. Because the use of sound was very important. You know, how loud it is in some points, but how quiet it is. When it's to do with Martin, it can be quite loud. When Celia is in the room and he turns on the heater and lets off a really red light and is really loud. Those things really add to the feeling of tension and also the feeling of Martin.
I'm a bit ambivalent about the portrayal of Celia, I have to say.
Mm.
And I don't want to overclaim this.
Did you feel sorry for her at the end? Do you feel sorry for her?
A little, but because she's been doing a lot of game playing, it's a bit hard. And playing with Andy as well as with Martin, I didn't. But when I sort of reflected on her character, and then went on to watch our other two films, Chopper and Romulus, My Father, women actually don't come out well of these films as portrayals.
Yeah.
And I don't want to overclaim it because these are three films out of many, many films. But interestingly, that we chose these three almost at random, and yet the women don't come out well. And it would be interesting to kind of sit back and reflect on all the Australian films and, you know, how do they perceive women, particularly up to, say, you know, the turn of the century or so. You know, are we a misogynistic culture? Although this is a film being made by a woman. But Celia's the bitch in the film, basically.
Yeah, no, she's a great character. I think she's just infatuated. No, but she's just yes, she plays games, but she's infatuated by him. And there's game playing on both sides there. So when she loses. Yeah, she loses. And I did actually feel a little bit sorry for her, I must say. I did in that moment. Because you suddenly learn, especially from after that, you're right, with that moment in the Melbourne Symphony Orchestra, when they go to the concert, which was quite funny looking at that, because I worked in the concert hall for many years.
A friend of mine is in the orchestra, actually.
The things I was standing on, I've held them many times. It felt very interesting seeing the old.
See, at that stage, we were playing Spot Libby.
Yeah, right. but that is the moment where you see a softer side, and when you suddenly see her house, and she's got so many pictures on the walls.
And it's quite funny, though. That the first time you see that, that's funny that Martin is sitting against a collage wall of him, you know, stalkery kind of photos.
That's right.
He has no idea of that. And when Andy ends up there, at first neither does he, and then he starts to realise. And so it's funny the first time, it's a bit something the second time, but also the difference in power all the way through the film, that people can have power over Martin because he can't see.
Mm-hmm.
So both Celia and Andy can watch him unobserved in the gardens. He has no idea they're there, really. Martin has no idea of this wall of him that he's sitting in, and he does have that power. And so as a film about, you know, the power the potential abuse of power over blind people is a really interesting part of the thread.
Yes, that's another element in an hour and a half. It packs a lot in.
Yeah, it's a work of craft for me. It really is.
It is. Well, let's go to scores. What are you going to give this?
I'll give it an 8.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if that's a bit low, but I give it an 8. It has dated a little way in some ways. For me, you know, it's a little film. You know, it's kind of almost a vignette, but it's so well realised, and there are such great little moments in it. I don't remember a film that I've seen that makes setting up a vacuum cleaner seem erotic. Like it's so well handled all the way through.
That's sort of quite an amazing scene. And, yes. You know, and even the scene which we touched on just before, when Andy is sitting there with the wall behind him, he doesn't say a word in that scene.
No. You see him processing it.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's another great performance from Russell Crowe as well, early, before Romper Stomper even. So all these guys were, you know...
And I sometimes can take or leave Russell Crowe. I agree with you. I think he's very, very good in this.
Mm.
So for me, it's an 8. What about you?
I'm giving it an 8 too.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm giving it an 8 too. I think I've touched on all the points of why. I think it's a wonderful film.
But definitely a director I just want more from.
Mm.
You know, and I know she's working on another film at the moment. It's in pre-production. Yeah. Can't wait.
Yeah. So the next film we're going to talk about is Romulus, My Father.
Okay, this 2007 film is the only one directed by well-known Australian actor Richard Roxburgh, most famous for playing Rake on Australian TV or Count Dracula in 2004's Van Helsing movie, but we won't hold that against him. Raymond Gaita is an Australian professor of moral philosophy of international repute. He was born in Germany a year after the end of World War II and emigrated to Australia just before his 4th birthday. This film is his autobiography, spanning family events either side of his 10th birthday in early 1960s rural Victoria. Young Raymond, played by Cody Smith McPhee, lives with his Romanian-born father, Romulus, played by Eric Banner. His parents are separated but still married. Romulus works hard as a metalsmith. He cares for Raymond and also provides support to his wife, Christina, played by German actress Franca Potenti. Christina now lives with his father's former close friend, Mitru, Russell Dykstra, and they are financially struggling. This situation becomes even more complex when Christina and Mitru have a child of their own, and Raymond spends time living with them in a nearby town. The fifth key character is Hora, Martin Sokas, Mitru's brother and Romulus's amazingly stalwart friend, who supports everyone else except Christina, whom he disapproves of. The child Raymond grows up in a world of adults, with barely another child to be seen until he goes to boarding school, other than his infant sister, who seems to spend most of her time crying or being pushed around in a pram. This adult world is a dark, tough place, and the film addresses poverty, domestic violence, mental health and postnatal depression, possibly prostitution, and suicide. The amazing thing is that Raymond grew up at all, let alone well-adjusted. But this film is a love letter to his father, brought out into the light to be examined, like his father's love letters that Raymond reads under the bed, and then healed, like the bees at the beginning and the end of the film. It's also an attempt to understand the behaviours of his mother, who both excites and shames him as a child, but for whom the adult Raymond has expressed an unassuaged longing. Ricardo, what did you think?
Look.
Uh-oh.
Let me put it this way. I'll tell you what I did like about it.
Uh-oh.
Okay. I think the performances are all very good. I think it's beautifully shot. It's a very good production, this movie. It's beautifully made. However, I've found it plodding, bleak, and quite boring, and I did not. I how much I love father son stories. I wasn't moved, and that was my biggest issue with it. I found it. Its story. I know as a book, I'm sure it would have been great, and it would have probably told the story really well.
And I'd like to read the book. Actually.
Yeah, I just found the movie didn't make me feel much for the characters, for the father, for their relationship. I didn't feel anything, and that's my main issue with it. I was wanting to love it. I sat there going, okay, then it's a nice imagery that we're getting into it. I thought, am I going to really find this, get into this movie? And I just didn't. I found it way too bleak.
Well, it is certainly bleak.
I know, yeah.
And I actually think that's one of its strengths. It's a bleak story. You've got a very luminous child. Like a lot of these really excellent films about, you know, childhoods, you get a great child actor. And I think Cody Smith with
he's awesome. Like I said, the performances are fine.
That gives it that luminescence at the centre of it all, but in a very bleak story. There's not really much in the way of let up. And you know, another filmmaker may have made it with, you know, leavened more with comic moments. A bit like, you know, we talked about the drive-in car chase scene in the middle of Proof.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been a different film, better film, maybe, maybe not. But I don't mind that because it's telling the reality of their lives. And yeah, I'll come back to that.
What really happens in this film, Greg? I mean, really, to me it just seemed like the same plot lines throughout the film. I mean, you've got the father, son, his wife who's obviously sleeping with other men and has issues there, and then they continue going through. She leaves and then she's sleeping with another man, then she gets pregnant. You know,
home for visits where she sleeps with her husband.
I just feel like that was the same, like it kept doing the same thing. And I'm going, well,
I think that's plotting. Part of the point. It does plod, but put that aside for a moment. The unremitting and the bleakness, I think, is part of the point. These are the lives these people were living. This is a world that you and I just don't enter into.
No.
But I recognise elements of it from the lives of my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that my grandfather had to leave his family
mm-hmm.
back in Broken Hill, where they came from, in New South Wales here, and went during the Depression. I know this is set later, but went mm-hmm. during the Depression and dug sewage pipes all over the eastern seaboard
mm-hmm.
because otherwise they had no money and they had to make do.
I think all migrant families were doing that. So I feel like my family were doing it as well. I thought connect to it that way a lot as well. I thought I would, and I didn't.
I think the problem with the film, when you call it slow and plotting and so on, it does go like that, but I actually think that's more because it's a bit episodic. So rather than kind of seeing a flow of events over a week, a year, whatever, you kind of see these almost sequences, these episodes that play out, and then you kind of in the next one, there's not often a link between them. And so I think structurally that is the problem with this film. And there were times I kind of thought, yeah, this is getting a bit slow. But I kept coming back to it because
I don't mind slow films, by the way. If I can be invested in the story, then I would. Mm. Then I'm absolutely fine. I'm not all needing whiz bangs. You know, fast pace. You know, I love movies like The Thin Red Line, which does plod for quite a while. But I like films where I can just get into the story, get into the characters, look at imagery. I mean, I really love that, and I thought I would get into this a lot more.
I would have liked to know a bit more about the mother. The mother was almost observed all the way through.
Yeah.
In a way that I don't think happened with the male adults.
Mm.
What I love about this film, apart from the detail and the look and the sense of what their world was really like, is I love the steadfast love, the quiet, steady love that Romulus has for his son, where things are just going wrong all the time, you know. Romulus can't take a break. Sometimes it's self-inflicted, like when he has the motorcycle accident.
Yes.
Sometimes there's circumstances completely beyond his control,
mm-hmm.
like when he finds out about that woman overseas at one point.
Yes. Yeah.
But, and that's the thing that finally breaks him, but where he just keeps pushing through and he's always trying to do the right thing by everyone. His wife leaves him. He won't divorce her.
No.
But she sets up with another man. They set up a house together. They have a child together. In real life, in fact, they had two daughters together. And he's there and he's giving them money when things are going tough. I mean, I can't begin to imagine doing that. You know, just the moral strength of this guy and the way he just embodies love captures me. The other character was Hora, the best mate.
Mm.
I mean, again, here's someone, he's quite clear that he does not like the mother, Christina.
No.
And there's a scene where she starts to try it on a bit with him, you know, flirting, mm. in, you know, half-dressed, and the look of disgust he gives her pretty much stops that happening. But otherwise, the way he is for young Raymond, for his brother, who he hates the fact that his brother set up with his best friend's wife.
That's right.
But he's there for everyone except the mother, but he's there for them all the way through and trying to do the right thing by them. And, yeah, the other little mini critique I've got of it is at the end, you know, before the credits, you get those kind of, you know, title cards that say Raymond went on to become a professor of philosophy.
That's right, yes.
I would like a bit more about that. Then you hear about his father, and his father did eventually remarry and then was buried in the cemetery near his mother.
Yeah.
Would like a bit more about that, but you hear nothing about Hora. And I really want to know what happened with him. He's a very interesting character.
He is a very interesting character. And you almost think, I was more interested in him than I was anybody else, really.
Do you think he was in love with the father?
No, I didn't think that.
I didn't the first time. This time around, I kind of thought, I wonder if there's a backstory here. He was just so devoted to the father, and he's trying to set him up with a woman overseas, even carrying the photograph. And the fact he shows absolutely no interest in the mother, which can just, not just, but solely be because of his friendship with the father. But I kind of wondered, is there something else going on here? And I don't want to read too much into that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he was just, a really deeply impressive person that I kind of felt we lost by the end of the film.
I think it could have done with a bit of an edit, honestly. I think it could have done with
a bit of an edit. Well, it is about 2 hours long, isn't it?
I think here we are. Yeah, well, it's an hour and 45 or something.
Yes, that's right.
Now, if we're looking at, say, Proof before, which packed a lot in and a lot of themes in a sort of 89 minutes, I think it was. I think this, the story within this film, I'm not sure about the books, I haven't read the book at all, but this film went on way too long. I think it could have been cut by 15 minutes and probably would have been a lot better.
Do you know what you would have cut?
You know what? I can't remember the actual scenes specifically, but I remember there were scenes where I was going, what is that doing? What is it meant to be doing?
Yeah, I think you could have cut out the scenes with the old guy on the hill where they cook
eggs
in urine.
Oh, my goodness, what the hell is it? Yes. Those scenes. Who is that guy? And I was just at Komen, right? But come on, he pops up every now and then. He's in the car.
No, he's only in two scenes.
And he's boiling, he's...
He's boiling his eggs in his urine. And then he drives the boy to deliver the chairs.
Really? Did it really have to be there? If you took those scenes out, would it really affect the story?
Well, I would have felt less grossed out.
Yeah, but I mean, I know it's there to give the son somebody else.
He's got horror for that. You don't need that character in the story.
You don't.
And I want to praise some other things about this film. I love the feel it has for Victorian landscape.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah, it's beautiful.
The dead trees and the lake is
beautifully done. Yeah.
And Richard Roxburgh originally is from Albury, so he knows that part of the world.
Yes.
Maryborough, where it's set, is north of Ballarat, so it's not far from Albury. He has a feel for that land.
Cinematography, it's beautiful, yeah.
Eric Banner, I think, is marvellous.
Yes, he's very good.
And if you contrast this performance with what we'll talk about next in Chopper.
Yes, yeah.
So in Chopper, he's a very kind of edgy, dangerous, probably psychotic character. Here, he's just this very quiet, steady man who has states, like you see a scene where he's obviously been through electroshock treatment, where he sits there comatose pretty much, or where he gets very upset or he's just been trying to be that very supporting kind of person. Mm. He does all that so well. Eric Banner is a very, very watchable actor.
Oh, he is, absolutely.
And the other thing is, I just love some of the imagery in this.
Franka Potente's very good as well, though. I think everybody's very.
I think she could be given a bit more to work with.
Yes, but I think everybody does their job in this movie well. I don't think there's a bad performance in this at all.
And some of the imagery, like all three of these films we talk about tonight, have a very striking image either right at the end or close to.
Yeah.
So in Proof, it was young Martin, touching the window and the light in the rain. In this one, at the beginning and the end, is the whole thing about releasing the bees.
Didn't get it, and I was not moved whatsoever.
I remember both times I've seen it, very struck by that imagery of the bees that have kind of hibernating or presumed dead, who then, come alive with warmth and heat. And I thought that was a metaphor for the father as well.
Yeah.
The other thing I could have done without is, why Hor was killing the chickens. That made no sense to me whatsoever.
They were sick.
Yeah, but what was the point of it in the story? Like, what was it about? And I have to say, it's one of the times in the final titles they say no animals were harmed in making this film, and I thought, not sure about the chickens. and we'll talk about imagery and Chopper, but there's such a strong visual film to this. I think you're right. I think the film's structure could be tightened, but I still really love this film. There's just something about it that I just find really watchable. And I'll go back and watch it again. Not every year, maybe not every 10 years, but I really enjoyed a second viewing and I can imagine doing the same in the future.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Maybe you need to watch it two or three times too.
Well, we're going to give a score.
Let's start with... Well, I'll give
you...
Start with mine because I really like this film. For me, it's an 8. I hovered towards 9, I have to say, but there No, I really like this film.
Wow.
I find it quite meditative.
Okay.
And I link that in my mind, rightly or wrongly, with the fact it's a story about a philosopher. That, I think the whole thing is very meditative and I really enjoy that. I'm not bored. I'm aware of slowness at times, but I'm not bored.
Okay, I'm giving it a 4.
Oh, in cabaret territory.
Yeah, I know. I don't want to be too harsh on the movie, right? But this is just my point of view of it. Okay,
that's right.
I can understand why you probably would like. I mean, you've been talking all about it. But for me, when I go to a movie, it's all about being moved. And I think, you know, like I said, the whole design of it, everything else about the film, like, is beautifully done. But, the fact that I wasn't moved and I couldn't get into the story that much, that's why I'm giving it a 4. And I found it too plotting and I was quite bored by it.
Would you want to see another film directed by Richard Roxburgh?
It'd be interesting to see what he would do next. It's probably a very personal film. Obviously, you love the story. So
and he's from that part of the world. That. He's so from that part of the world.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to see what he does. I mean, he's a great actor. He's a great actor.
Yes.
So it'd be interesting to see what he would do. I'm not sure. It's been 10 years, whether he will direct or not.
It might just have been a passion project for him.
You know, and which is fine. But to me, it's all about the pacing, I think, in the movie. And the story, that didn't capture me as much as it did you.
Okay, so let's go from one Eric Banner film to another. Ricardo, why don't you tell us about Chopper?
Firstly, this wasn't on purpose, by the way. We actually chose these films. Only afterwards I went, oh, these were Eric Banner movies.
We do try and keep it a bit diverse.
It just happened this way. Anyway, Chopper. Filmed in the year 2000, Chopper is one of those crime dramas that just sticks with you. Its plot centres around Mark Brandon Chopper Reed, the charismatic crime figure and best-selling author, who can't even spell, played sensationally by Eric Banner in the role that launched him beyond the shores of Australia, where he'd already made a name for himself as a comedian in the comedy show Full Frontal. As a comedian, he was always very funny, but in this film, he takes performance to another level, becoming the notoriously unpredictable Chopper. The film begins with Chopper in prison, watching a TV interview he did from prison. Then it moves back in time with him in prison serving a 16-year sentence. Here he stabs a prisoner to death to become the leader of the prison's maximum security H division. But this makes him enemies and puts a price on his head. And when he's stabbed by his close friend Jimmy, Simon Linden, he asks to be moved from H division, but the authorities won't let him. So he has his ears hacked off on purpose, which makes it happen. After he serves his sentence, Chopper finds it really difficult on the outside, revisiting enemies and friends. He unsuccessfully reunites with a prostitute ex-girlfriend before shooting an old crime foe, Neville Bartos, very funny, Vince Colosimo, which puts another price on his head. Then the film focuses on the shooting of Sammy the Turk at a bar, which lands him in prison again, where he's able to write his bestseller. Look, it's a stunning debut for a director, Andrew Dominik, who also made it in Hollywood after this by making films such as The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford and Killing Me Softly with Brad Pitt. These are good films, but his style in this film is a standout. From the colouring of the film to his use of slow-mo and even the fast motion when replicating the taking of the drug Speed, where the voices are all normal speed while the vision is sped up. It's so filmic and a brilliant, funny, dramatic, violent, psychotic portrayal that I believe deserves to have its cult following. It's just a great film. Greg.
No. No.
Break. Come on, Greg.
There is one terrific thing about this film, and that is Eric Banner's performance. That is really terrific. Like, he is great in the part. I totally believe the character he's playing. I get the character he's playing.
Yes.
I get the fact that sometimes he doesn't mean to be violent and psychotic. It just kind of happens, and then he's kind of almost a bit bemused by the fact he's been like that. So that is great. But I have two problems with this film. The first one is I just don't enjoy it very much as a film. I just don't. There were odd things. So there's the bit where they're having the trial over the shooting in the car park, and you see these kind of very theatrical stage scenes where the characters are talking, I think, in rhyming couplets about what happened.
Yes. And which was fantastic.
No,
I thought it was brilliantly done.
I thought it was half-hearted.
No.
I thought it was kind of stuck in there and they didn't quite know what to do. It was like, yeah, okay, I know. It just didn't reach me. My second problem with this film is a moral problem. This film is about the glorification of Chopper. It's about Chopper the character and so on.
Absolutely.
As well. But it's also about the fact that he becomes glorified by the media.
Well, he does, yeah.
And the film itself is perpetuating that problem, and I have a real problem with it.
But it happens all the time. I mean, geez, yeah, you can't like a film like Goodfellas or those sorts of films.
Well, I don't watch those kind of films either. Yeah, well, that's you do.
Yeah, that's right. But, I mean, it happens all the time.
Is Goodfellas is a true story?
Yes, it is. And I think it happens all the time. People, see, I find this all the time here, but people tend to talk about this moralistic thing with Australian sort of crime figures. It happened with Underbelly and all the rest of it. But then, you know, when they're happily watching Goodfellas, they're happily watching anything else from sort of an American perspective.
But I'm not.
I know you're not, but other people are. But then when it comes to Australia, suddenly it's glorifying and it's moralistic, you know, and I'm sitting there going, well, this is an enjoyable portrayal of this character. And I have to say I've
not encountered that. I haven't met people who've liked one and not the other.
Oh, well, I have, yeah.
Maybe I don't speak to people who generally like those films. These, other than you're the only exception in my life.
Oh, but look,
I just really struggle with the fact the death of a real person, they're trying to make it comic.
Which bit did they try and make
comic? Oh, about, you know, they mucked it up about which car park they should be in, and meanwhile on the other side of the building they're running around trying to work out what to do.
Well, that's a story about what happened. I mean, yeah. I don't think they made it completely.
Family seeing that. No, it wasn't Keystone Cops or anything.
No.
I did not find Vince Colosimo funny. I'm sorry.
I found him hilarious. Oh, no. Come on.
No.
He's hilarious. Neville Bardos, here, no cash. Cash, not here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, it's funny. I find it hilarious. I find those sequences hilarious, but I find Chopper such an easy watch. I can watch it from start to finish, and I will never watch it again. Oh, give me a break.
No, I just.
But the filmic qualities of it are so beautiful as well. It's so well shot and brilliant.
Well, maybe if you're looking at a technical perspective, I'd say all that passed me by. So I think you're probably better placed to pick up on that. And I'm not saying it's not real. I'm just saying I didn't tap into that at all. I just sat there the whole time thinking there's a certain amount of interest in this as a local history kind of thing. And it was, you know, really interesting to watch scenes that were filmed in Pentridge, which is the old jail.
Yeah,
there,
that's right.
Which is where they actually took place, but which has now been decommissioned and been, I think, turned into apartments or something. Yeah. So you can see how they got access to film in that environment as well. So I found parts of it interesting from an historical perspective, but I just felt that the film is perpetuating the problem I have with what the story was trying to sort of point out.
That was the point.
Yeah, but the film does it too. It's not a critique. It's not a critique. It's a celebration.
But that's the point.
Yeah, well...
Oliver Stone did it in Natural Born Killers. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't seen it. Well, this genre obviously doesn't call to me in the slightest.
Yeah, I think it's doing the same thing. I mean, he was celebrated by the media. I mean, so many gangster figures have been. I mean, look at the Underbelly series and whatnot. Gangitanos and all the rest of them. They're very celebrated figures. Nova 100, you know, the radio station, did a whole thing with Roberta Williams, you know, going around to all the places where all these murders happened and whatnot. I find that quite odd and bizarre to be doing that.
I'm not interested in any of this.
No.
And as soon as I guess part of my problem is as soon as I feel that these are real people's lives being portrayed in this way, as entertainment, you've lost me.
Mm.
The other interesting thing I found about the film is most of the people involved in that underworld are just not bright.
No, they're not. And I'm not saying that these characters are great people either. I mean, you can watch it, they're awful, awful characters, really are. It's an awful world. It really is. It is an awful world. But the lightness of it is because you're watching this other world and you're not in that world, so it's a bit intriguing, you know. I know a lot of people who are like, you know, the Shawshank Redemption and those prison films, you know, and a lot of those prison-y sort of films, because it's another world, that's an intriguing world.
I like the Shawshank Redemption, but I would never compare these films in any way other than the fact they're set in jails.
Mm.
I mean, we should talk about the Shawshank Redemption. It's a film I came to very, very late in the piece, and I now understand why people really love that film.
Particularly footballers. AFL footballers, every time they ask what your favourite movie is, they always say The Shawshank Redemption. It's quite a joke.
Oh, that's Aussie rules for people.
It is Aussie rules football, yeah.
Yeah, no, look, I'm just not interested. Where did he get his name Chopper from? Wasn't the ear thing.
It mustn't. I'm not actually sure about that. I thought it was the ear thing, but they mentioned Chopper in the jail before the ear thing. So I'm not exactly sure.
Sorry, this is a
diary
Dixon for me. I actually know. Well, I think I know. So the reason he was in jail in the first place was that he was a standover merchant where he would kidnap people who were, you know, dealing drugs or had money, whatever, and he would chop off their toes with a bolt cutter. It gets a mention at one point in the film.
Yes, it does get mentioned.
And
actually,
he talks about the way he loves the way they fly off and so on.
Yes, yeah.
But do you know why he was in jail?
It was because I think it was to do with Jimmy.
Yeah, he kidnapped the judge, who was overseeing Jimmy, which makes Jimmy's betrayal then all the more interesting. And because obviously Jimmy, is it Bluey or Blue, the other guy?
Yeah.
Played by Dan Wiley.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, they obviously realised he had gone over the top and they had no choice than to follow his wake and end up in a very bad place. So they decide they're going to bump him off.
Mm.
So I find little bits of that story interesting, but I just don't like the tone. And I have real problems with this celebration.
Look, I don't think it is a celebration. I don't think it is. I think it's an insight into the character and the mind of this guy. This unpredictable, you know, I mean, who pretty much portrays it as the Robin Hood of the criminal world, of just, you know, knocking off the bad guys, you know, and he's the good guy.
You think he comes across as the good guy in the story? Because I don't.
No.
Oh, right.
No, but I'm just saying that's what they try and portray him as, like the Robin Hood of the criminal world. Like, you know, he bumps off the bad guys, so who cares? You know, he's doing good, you know.
Not Robin Hood, he's kind of the cleaner.
Yeah, the cleaner, right? He's got an interesting way of speaking, and obviously his books have become bestsellers because of that. I don't think it's a celebration at all, actually. I think it's quite sad, actually. And when you look at the end of the film, when after the interview and the cops leave and he's left there alone in his cell, and it's sad.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's ultimately a celebration, because, you know, when in those scenes when he's... when he goes into the house and that awful scene, which I find really hard to watch every time it comes up, when he actually bangs down the door of his girlfriend's
and beats
up the mother as well, that's not funny. That's not celebrating the character at all. That's actually, look, you're going, this is a really, you know, effed up human being.
And the same with the child.
Yeah.
The girl, Sharon or Shannon, whatever her name was, when he goes to Jimmy's house to work out if he's behind a new contract or not.
What's celebratory about that?
No, not some of the scenes, but I think the film is still celebrating kind of the quirky humour of his character.
But he is that.
Yeah, but...
He is that.
I
think a film like Goodfellas celebrates it so much more than this film.
Well, I can't comment. But this film, as far as I'm aware, was also really the making of the real-life Chopper Reed, because now he's got this film about him that is making him a celebrated persona. Now, I have no way of knowing if that was Andrew Dominik's intent, but it's certainly the way I read it.
Well, he already was. He was already quite celebrated. And his books, I mean, he's not only did one book. I mean, it's so many books. He's written Chopper 1, 2, 3.
Oh, he's written about 8 or 12.
Yeah, that's right.
Including a children's book.
That's right. And he passed away a few years ago now. So, I think it was worth... I mean, you've got your Ned Kelly stories or whatnot. I'm not saying I'm not putting him to Ned Kelly at all, but it'd be...
Well, I found myself thinking of Ned Kelly watching this film, and I think he pales against Ned Kelly.
Mm.
I think Ned Kelly was responding against injustice.
Yes.
And he was trying to do a bit of a Robin Hood thing. He was trying to be a bit of a noble character.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't see this in the Chopper character at all, in reality or in the film. And look, the reality of this is you and I are not going to agree on this film.
No, we're not. Let's talk about scores here. What are you going to give this?
5.
Really?
Yeah, so I liked it more than you liked Romulus, My Father.
Yeah.
My 5 is purely for Banner's performance, because he is very watchable, even in the scenes where I was really squirming, like the chopping of the ears off.
Every moment.
He's very believable. I really feel like I'm watching a real character all the way through. So I think it's a superb performance. There were things that I found interesting in the story about some of the cultural things, like just the lack of brightness. You know, why would you let him into your house when you know he's a violent, unpredictable character and he might have got the word on the fact that you actually are part of this contract relationship to bump him off? You know, you're stupid to let him in. It's just beggars belief. So there were things in there I found interesting, but I feel generous on a 5 and I'll never watch it again.
Okay. I'm giving it... a 9. I think it's a classic Australian film. I think it's a classic. I mean, look, I do enjoy that this sort of genre. I do enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is one of the films I really like. And let's not say, you know, that's why I didn't like Romulus, My Father, because I like these sorts of films, you know. I keep referencing Goodfellas and Scorsese a little bit in this, while I'm talking about it here, because when it first starts, the movie. I think it lends itself to that sort of genre a lot, and I think it's wonderful. So 9 for me.
Yeah, I don't. And the other interesting thing I learned about this when I was trying to read a bit around it after I watched it. So the film opens with shots of the old Pentridge prison,
yeah,
and the blue, you know, slightly cloudy skies above, while Frankie Lane is singing Don't Fence Me In, which, yeah, is kind of nice. That wasn't their first choice. Mm. Their first choice was Billy Thorpe, another early Australian rocker, singing Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Yeah, right.
And he absolutely refused to let his version of that song be used. I'm really, like, he's dead now. I don't know how you find out. I'm really curious to know why he refused. But I think I'm with Billy.
Mm. So that concludes our episode 5, Aussie.
Oi,
episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Next up, we're actually going to do something a bit fun on my behalf. I don't think Greg finds it that fun.
Greg does not find this fun.
But we're going to delve into some horror films, okay? So now, it's a genre I've loved. I used to go to the video shop when I was a teenager, and that was the first section I'd go to. I loved this genre. I loved it a lot.
And I did not.
Yes. So we're going to have a look at it, and I love putting Greg out of his comfort zone, so let's do that.
No one will be surprised to learn that all three of these films you have seen, and I have not.
That's right. Well, this is a good one. This is different. We can be different here. So the first film.
No. I don't know if we actually talked about this beforehand, about the fact we're going to have guest podcasts from time to time. So if I'm not actually here next time, and somebody else turns up, they're my official delegate, and it will be fine.
Well, it's going to be quite a fun episode
It could be the episode where I turn up not watching the films and just try to, you know, tap dance my way through. Oh, I was scared by that thing, yes.
This reaction is going to make it quite a fun episode, okay? So the first film we're going to look at...
everyone in the world except me.
That's right. Is going to be The Babadook, okay, which is an Australian horror film.
From only a couple of years ago.
And then we're going to look at a classic, I feel, is a Wes Craven classic, and you have to do Wes Craven. Is going to be A Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, not the remake. And then we're going to delve into another Wes Craven film, Scream, which I think is going to be a scream.
And sorry, which of those three was the musical? So we hope you enjoyed this final episode of our podcast.
I think it's going to be fun.
See you next time.